Well, we're back again with the second half of the Extraordinary Science Radio Hour. J.W. McGinnis here with my guest, Dr. Paul LaViolette. And we've been talking about the Beyond the Big Bang, and this is a hell of a book, folks. This one here will give you some correlations that you might not have pondered on before, but after you see the evidence that Dr. LaViolette has compiled and the way that he has integrated it into modern science and so forth, really is an eye-opener. I highly recommend the book. It's called Beyond the Big Bang, and you can order this book by calling 800-715-9993. Now, you need to call between 8 and 4 Eastern Standard Time, 8 and 4 Eastern Standard Time. That's Monday through Friday, okay? 800-715-9993. Well, when we left off, Dr. LaViolette, we had a few areas we haven't brought to a conclusion yet. One of them, of course, we were talking about the Sphinx, and the other one is the galaxy. And well, I'm going to let you make these comparisons of where the energy is coming from. What's going on?
Yeah, well, you find that in this continuous creation cosmology ancients were talking about, that the center of the galaxy would be the region where you'd expect most of the matter to be created. That you can imagine the evolution of the galaxy, what happened. You had some stars forming early on, and that the matter is producing more matter. It's a continuous process. So you actually have growth where new stars are forming in the vicinity of existing stars. So it's a sort of inward going out rather than outward coming in, like in the Big Bang Theory, everything condensing. This is sort of growing from within. You're developing sort of initially a star cluster, and it keeps populating more and more. Pretty soon you have an elliptical galaxy. Then your original star that's at the center, the primordial star, is now very massive. It's essentially just a core at this point. It's ejected its atmosphere. It's become very energetic. Not a black hole. Now, in this cosmology, you don't have black holes. It's actually a very positive view, because you're able to generate energy spontaneously, almost. It's coming, it's a nonlinear system, understand, so energy is able to emerge spontaneously in physics. And so you find that this ancient core at the center of the galaxy is going to be your prime radiator of energy and matter. And this is actually what we find, that gas is moving out from the center of the galaxy, and it's one of the most powerful sources of energy in the galaxy.
Well, energy is matter, is it not? You know, we say we can't destroy matter because it transforms into energy. And it would seem to be that if we have energy, it itself propagates the matter.
They're interchangeable.
Yeah.
And, of course, and we see in other galaxies, too, that the centers are very active. Now, what's interesting is not only did, in the case of the Zodiac, now remember, these are constellations that are out there, 12 constellations along the ecliptic. Now, you find that this not only spells out this physics of creation, but also points out the center of the galaxy and indicates this is the prime region for creation of matter and energy, which is totally amazing, because we just discovered where the center of the galaxy was accurately with the invention of radio telescopes. Before that, it was sort of very assumptive by saying, well, there's globular clusters in a general area, and we can extrapolate where the center is from those clusters. And that was done around 1920s or 30s, and they came within 3 degrees of finding the exact center using that technique. Now, the Zodiac with pointers actually points this out. There are two Zodiac constellations that have sort of pointer indicators in them. And with citing those, you come to within a few tenths of a degree of arc, which is about 10 times closer than they did using the Mount Palomar telescope back then. To surpass that accuracy, you'd need radio telescope. So you wonder, how did they know this location? Did they have this equipment, or was there maybe an outburst from the center of the galaxy where that region, which today is hidden by clouds, we just can't see that part even with telescopes, normal telescopes, because it's full of dust clouds.
Yeah.
Was it possible that back then there was a galactic explosion, and this would have been very bright in the sky? And maybe this is related to the climatic catastrophes that were happening that we hear legends of.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I discuss this in my next book after this. It's a sequel to Beyond the Big Bang.
Well, when they go back, you know, I was watching one of these programs, and they were, the particular topic was the Star of Bethlehem, what the wise men had followed in search of the Magi. And they said it although in these days it would not show up, if we transgressed, we moved time back and brought the migration of these stars and planets back into the alignment that they were at approximately 2,000 years ago, then they start to identify typical stars and planets that could have been in themselves the guiding light that the wise men followed.
Uh-huh.
And so now what you're getting at is that the advancement of science has actually established you know, some truly remarkable facts here that you correlated before you know, was even announced. So you've got something going there, Dr. LaViolette, and it's something that I know that you treasure yourself, and you're the first person out there, and you have elaborated you know, quite completely on this, in, at least in this particular book, and you have more coming. But I would just suggest that our listeners, if they get an opportunity, give a call. Get this book. It's 800-715-9993, and you want to call between 8 and 4, that's Eastern Time, Monday through Friday. So wherever you're at, it costs you nothing, and you get this book, and you'll have your eyes opened widely by the time you finish reading the book. Now, we were also on the topic of the Sphinx and its riddle. But yes. there's some other things that come in, and we're talking about a portal.
The idea of a Stargate portal.
Yeah.
When you study ancient Egyptian myths, there's what's called the Acher Sphinx, which is half lion, half man, head of the man. And this symbolized for the Egyptians the entrance to the underworld. Now, for them, the underworld was the netherworld, really, the beyond, where the soul goes after death. So you understand that really they were talking about the a higher dimensional realm, the ether, which they viewed in, I believe, in multidimensional terms. Their ether was more than three dimensions. And so here you have very prosaic, I mean, it's incredible. These people were artists. Depicting with stone form so large, and you view the Sphinx now with the understanding that symbolically you go into its breast and you are entering the beyond, this this higher dimension. It's almost like what happens when you have the out-of-body experience and you see there's more than just the three dimensions. Now for them, this was the domain in which the real essence of existence was taking place. The physical, what we see, is just the epiphenomenon, the superficial, what the Hindus call maya, the illusion. That really all of this is, these are just waves on the surface of this real substance, which is the ether, which is more than just three dimensions. And that's why they did the Assyrians, the Assyrian mysteries took place under the Sphinx, it is said. Whether they actually had a passage that went down, or else that the people were blindfolded when they metaphorically taken through this.
Well, this is a lot of speculation on this. Everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, but you get some of these researchers now that are out there, and they're claiming that there's a huge underground
vault or room that they're excavating. I understand they're doing some excavation right now.
Yeah, I think what they did is they ran some sonic test on it, and they discovered this hollow down there. And now they're going to try to seek it out, but try to find the pathway that brought them down rather than, you know, just cutting a hole down there, if you know what I mean. That probably mean a lot of excavation around the Sphinx. We have thousands of years of desert buildup, sand shifting and so forth. But it's something that I'm sure that they uncover it, the world is going to be... right at their peak, wanting to know what in the heck is there.
Yeah. Now, besides this idea of the entrance to the netherworld, you have at the same time that the Sphinx is representing these four fixed signs, and it's actually a key to decoding the zodiac cryptogram. Now, mm-hmm. When I say decoding, when you look at the 12 signs of the zodiac, first of all, there is no particular starting point that you can see because they're in a circle. But when you understand the physics, you see that there is one particular sign. I won't say because I want the person to read the book to see if they can do it themselves. It's sort of like a game in a way. I give certain hints there for a person to try that. There's one sign which there's certain symbols associated with it which indicate beginning. And you begin there. Now, it happens, I'll give this clue, that it's one of the four fixed signs of the Sphinx. See, the Sphinx becomes the key. It shows you where to start and where to end the sequence. And you have to really shuffle the zodiac signs around from their present order to decode, to get them in the order that would depict this physics. Now, when I first did this myself, you know, I was saying, hey, they are not in the same order that you find in the Tarot. The Tarot has the exact right sequential order.
Yeah.
And I thought, could it be that I'm just seeing this, you know, it's just sort of ink blot effect. And I said, well, let me just go ahead. I don't like this order. I have to put these in this new order to arrange this properly. And then when I got done, I saw something that just bowled me over.
Oh, yeah?
It's the polarities and qualities that are associated with each sign. You know, polarities, whether the sign is plus or minus,
yeah,
masculine or feminine.
Yeah.
Now, in their present order, that varies regularly, plus, minus, plus, minus. When I got done reordering them, again, that was preserved, plus, minus, plus, minus.
Hmm.
And the qualities, whether it's a cardinal, fixed, or mutable sign, again, that's a regular sequential order. It keeps repeating a regular pattern, so it's like ordered initially. Now, you'd think, well, when you get done reordering, that's going to be all scrambled. Now, what you find is when you put them in this particular order to explain this physics, a new order emerges, which is actually depicting the concept that they're trying to explain.
Mm-hmm.
So not only is it ordered, but it's ordered differently from the initial order, but it is an ordered pattern and depicting this idea of bifurcation, the separation of heaven and earth, the emergence of matter,
mm-hmm.
of the yin and yang separating.
Right.
The yin becoming greater, the yang less, or the yang increasing in yin.
And again, you know, it is, you know, universal law almost when you start to... put this whole thing together. Folks, you're listening to the Extraordinary Science Radio Hour. Dr. Paul LaViolet is my guest. We're talking about Beyond the Big Bang. This book here will leave you tossing and turning, and I know you'll have a much better concept about what is going on out there. Now, if you want to get the book, what you've got to do is give a call. Now, it's got to be between 8 and 4, Monday through Friday, and you call it at 800-715-9993. That's 800-715-9993. Give them a call. Get this book on your shelf. It'll give you some insight that you just haven't had before. And it's unique, it's different, and it's well-researched, and it's been produced by a very solid scientist. So this is one that I highly recommend. Now, another thing that I want to tell all you folks, and that is on the... on another book, it's really hot. Now, you all know that George Wiseman was producing Brown's Gas 2, Well, he still hasn't gotten it out here. I don't know what's happened to George here lately, but he's not exactly on the hot seat because he has produced another book, and this book is just flying off the shelves, and it's called Brown's Gas Special Edition. This year is going to show you how to construct the electrolyzer and so on and so forth so that you can, run a car or do any number of different things. George, as usual, describes it very clearly so that you won't have any problem in constructing this electrolyzer. So you want to get this book. You want to understand more about Brown's Gas. This is one to get. It's only $24.95, and it is available by giving us a call at the Society. It's 800-397-0137. 800-397-0137. Now, on Brown's Gas, too, we still haven't gotten it. And I know there's a lot of you people that have ordered it. Now, if you're tired of waiting, why give us a call and we'll arrange to credit you back your account. But again, I'm just a little mystified with George. I don't know where he's at lately. I've been trying to get him on the phone, but he must be out there doing something. But in any case, we've got the book, Brown's Gas Special Edition, $24.95. You want to get it today? It is a masterpiece. And understanding Brown's Gas as well as constructing the electrolyzer. Okay? All right. My guest is Dr. Paul LaViolette, and we're talking about his book. It's a great one. It's called Beyond the Big Bang, and it is a book that really brings some fabric together between the ancient mythology that has been out there, some of the old ancient books like the Tarot and so forth. And he ties it in with modern scientific observation. And Dr. LaViolette, these correlations that you're coming up with are actually assisting the serious researcher in finding these centers of creation and so forth, doesn't it? Well, by that, what I'm talking about is when you're confronted with a problem that is displaying some mystery out there in the great divide, that some of those answers can be focused by coming up to what did the ancients say about this particular observation and how did they address it. And
In a way, the ancients can become our teachers, in a way.
Right.
This physics provides a different framework for understanding what we're seeing with observational astronomy. Now, the physics, subquantum kinetics, understand, I developed it independently. I'd already developed it based on my knowledge of non-equilibrium systems. And it was only later I saw the connection to the ancient writings. So just to understand, it didn't emerge out of the ancient symbolism. It's really quite firmly based scientific concept.
All right.
But when you adopt this new perspective that you're dealing with the physical world, that matter is really emergent pattern of transmuting ether processes that are continually going on. And that it's possible for energy to emerge spontaneously, or the opposite. You can have energy disappear from the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not, we're not talking about a huge amount. When we're talking about these natural processes, we're talking about rates which can't be measured in the laboratory with normal tools, because they're, for example, light wave would lose only 10% of its energy in a billion years. In the kind we're talking about that could explain the redshifts. So here we get an alternative to the expanding universe.
Mm-hmm.
So the ancient science leads to a universe that's not expanding, where light is instead actually losing energy as it comes from the distant galaxy.
Now, when we observe these distant galaxies or stars and so forth, we can determine if they're moving away from us or if they're approaching us by that color. Is that right?
You can't really, because if it's redshifted, the question is that due to the motion of the galaxy away from us? It's what's called a Doppler shift, sort of like the train whistle dropping in pitch. Or is it that the galaxy really isn't moving away from us, but that those light waves, as they're coming to us, could they have lost energy? Because as you lose energy, your wavelength becomes more toward the red part of the spectrum.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's really difficult to distinguish those directly from the observation until you plot all your data on a graph.
Yeah.
Then you take your two hypotheses. One is the expanding universe hypothesis. The other has come to be called the tired light hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And you see which comes closer, which is what I did. And I found that on four different cosmology tests, the tired light model came closer. The idea of the universe being stationary, cosmologically stationary, but light losing energy as it travels.
Okay.
And that hasn't been challenged since it was published. I published that in Astrophysical Journal. It's been cited in review articles and so on. And it's considered an alternative interpretation of the redshift.
Now, do you think that when these ancients had provided these observations and let us some clues behind, that they were really trying to transmit this to the future, or what's your take on it?
Yes, I believe it was a concerted effort that they encoded it in many myths as a way of ensuring its survival to the future, so that if there was a chance that one myth details were lost, then maybe some of the other myths, the details would be more efficiently preserved.
Mm-hmm.
And that it came through many cultures. You see this science in ancient Greek, ancient Egyptian, Babylonian, Chinese, even in Polynesia, there's a myth that resembles to a large extent parts of it.
Well, do you think some large catastrophe took the civilization and flattened it down to, sheepskins and clubs, and then we resurrect ourselves, learning step by step all over that which is already there?
This is what the conclusion you come to, because some of these myths that are transmitting this knowledge talk about a major catastrophe. And I believe the scenario, what happened, they saw the situation, they understood what was going to happen, that there was going to be a collapse of civilization, the science and language would be lost, the ability to communicate scientific concepts into the future in a normal way, like through teaching, would be lost. And so at that point, they encoded these ideas in the myths. They were also, I believe, trying to make people aware that this thing really happened, this catastrophe really happened. And you find, for example, in the Zodiac, that not only they're presenting the physics, but they're pointing out the center of the galaxy. I believe they're actually talking about an explosion of the center of the galaxy that involved cosmic rays coming to the Earth. And I won't say more than that here, because that will be the subject of my next book.
Okay.
But I think that this is basically what happened, that there was this dark ages intervening, and this was the way of the ancient cultures to communicate knowledge of something that they were afraid would be forgotten, but shouldn't be forgotten, because it's a recurrent phenomenon. It's a cosmic phenomenon that recurs, and something we should be very much aware of today.
So I felt pretty much like you do on that. Seeing the rise of civilization, and then a catastrophe comes along, and it's smitten down to nothing, and you're just like an ant. You're starting all over again. And when I see from time to time on television, there'll be a special on some sort of an archaeological find. They'll find a temple, they'll find a wheel, or they'll find some ancient battery, or, you know, all sorts of different things. It does give one pause to really think about these people had to be at least as intelligent as us. They made observations that go beyond what we ourselves are able to do. And as an example, we have the Pleiades. So we have a constellation of, of seven stars, yet six are what's visible. There's seven out there. And they established that once we got into these launches. We got a different astrological viewpoint than what we have right here on Earth. But These were clearly and accurately described by the ancients, myth or legend or fact. That goes back thousands of years, and we're still scratching our heads on it, because although we have found the temple, although we have found the battery, it's pretty much a fact that it's stone. There's no modern metals involved. What do you think about that? As far as the materials themselves, when we find the materials, they're stonework, and we don't find that refined metal.
Well, as we know, iron rusts, so there's that problem. They have found some iron pieces in the pyramid, I understand, which dated before the Iron Age. Some of these discoveries are challenging archaeological concepts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even copper, you'd expect, would rust after a certain length of time.
Mm-hmm.
So really, these stone structures are going to be all that would be left. If some of these things could be even 30,000 years old, if you had a civilization back that far, you would expect the main thing that'll be left is stone.
Well, I guess you're right there. I hadn't thought of that. And I don't know if you saw this battery that they discovered. It was somewhere in the Arabian Desert there somewhere. And it was
2,000 or so years old.
At least. And it was stone. It looked like an egg, and on the inside it was filled with carbon dust. And, the basic materials for making a battery. And it's just amazing. That was not formed naturally, although you do find those ultimate skeptics that they believe, everything is fixed. Our guest is Dr. Paul LaViolette. You're listening to the Extraordinary Science Radio Show, being brought to you by the International Tesla Society. And I encourage all of you listeners out there to become a member, an active member, in the most fascinating scientific organization in the world today. It's very simple. Have your credit card ready. Call our order hotline. It's 800-397-0137. And once you become a member, you'll be getting our magazine, you'll be getting our newsletter, you'll be getting the resource guide, you'll be getting the literature updates, you'll be getting discounts on various items in the resource guide, you'll be getting discounts for our science conferences that we conduct every summer. It's a great organization to belong to. It's an organization that does want to make this world a better place to live. And you can do your part by becoming a member. And becoming a member today will just help brighten our tomorrows. So do it today, won't you? It's 800-397-0137. Well, we've been having a fascinating interview here with Dr. LaViolette and his book, Beyond the Big Bang. For those that wish to order that book, give them a call, 800-715-9993, 800-715-9993. Those hours are between 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. Monday through Friday. That's Monday through Friday, and it's Eastern time. So just figure out, what's the best convenient time for you to call, and just match it up with Eastern time there, and they'll take care of you, okay? All right. Now, Dr. LaViolette, we've got about 2 minutes left here.
Yes.
Give us a kind of an overview of some of the other things that we haven't brought out here that I might have overlooked in talking about this book, because you have so many fascinating things in there. It's easy to concentrate on some of the big ones, but you got a lot of subtle ones in here, too.
Yeah. Well, one is I believe this is more compatible with mystical view, this view of the universe. The idea that there's more than just the physical, so much of science today is based on positivism.
Yeah.
Not looking beyond the objective.
Yeah.
And all the religions talk about the physical being emergent from some beyond, something that was pre-existing.
Right.
And it is invisible to the eye.
Well, I'll tell you what, this book will leave you thinking. I'll guarantee you that. And once again, if you want to get the book, it's 800-715-9993. Thanks again, Dr. LaViolette, for spending this hour with us, and good luck on the book. And we'll have you back in again to talk about your next book, if not more of this book. That concludes the Extraordinary Science Radio Hour for this week. Have a good week ahead of you, and we'll be back again next week, same time, same bat channel. Have a good one. Bye-bye.